talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning. It is February 8th. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. We're going to talk about movies all morning. This is going to be great. Let's start with the top 10 over the weekend. Is that Jane Got Her Gun? Is that doing a little better?
That made a comeback.
It's not even in the top 12.
Well, it was 17 last week.
Yeah, it was 17. Yeah. I was going to say, you were going to say it's not in the top 20.
Thanks for the reminder. Here are the official worldwide weekend box office estimates for the weekend of February 7th from what's now ComScore, formerly Rentrack.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. A side note. At number one is Kung Fu Panda 3 from 20th Century Fox with $21 million. The third film in the franchise is the number one movie globally for the second consecutive week, taking in $44 million in just eight territories and boasts nearly $200 million in revenue to date. So we will be seeing another Kung Fu Panda.
Well, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I had a feeling it would top the box office again this
mm-hmm.
weekend.
Yeah, you called that last week.
Yeah.
Hail Caesar took the number two spot with a meager $11.4 million from 2,222 theaters over the Super Bowl weekend.
That's better than I would have expected.
It's actually the lowest wide opening for Joel and Ethan Coen's directing career. And number three is The Revenant from 20th Century Fox with $7.1 million. The director, Alejandro G. Iñárritu, won the DGA on Saturday evening, and the movie continues to get a big bear hug from audiences around the globe as it adds another $31.1 million this weekend for an impressive $326.1 million total and counting.
Well, that is impressive. It hit the $300 million mark.
I'm really surprised.
I'm surprised it's in the top three again this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought that there wouldn't have a lot of big legs, I guess.
Yeah, but it's got all the momentum going into the Oscars.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep. At number four was Star Wars The Force Awakens. That brought in for the weekend $6.9 million. On Friday and Saturday, it broke the $2 billion mark.
Wow, $2
billion. Oh, yes. That's nice.
That's something.
You know, buy you a lot of Death Stars with that.
And we still have, you know, another Star Wars movie opening up in December.
Yeah.
We will until here, until
well,
2020.
Well, a spinoff, yes.
A spinoff, exactly.
Yes, not official, so...
Yeah, the next one comes out, was it 2017, episode 8?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, that's what they've said.
At number 5 was The Choice from Lionsgate. Audiences made the decision to avoid the latest Nicholas Sparks adaptation.
And that's a good decision.
It was so bad. And the romantic drama brought in a paltry $6.1 million for the weekend. Also failing to find an audience was Sony's Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. The movie came in at number 6 with a dismal $5.2
million. That would do better.
I did too.
I teenage girls would be all over that.
Well, we liked it.
Yeah.
Hey, you two did, yes.
Yeah.
Jim didn't like it.
We did. See, Disney's The Finest Hours was number 7 with a weekend total of $4.7 million. The Chris Pine, Casey Affleck film now stands at $4 million domestically.
Just $4 million?
$44 million domestically.
I was going to say, that's still pretty low. That's at least a $100 million movie, I would think.
I think that's, you know, the whole early year opening. At number 8 was Ride Along 2 from Universal Pictures. The Kevin Hart Ice Cube buddy cop film took in $4.5 million for the weekend. Domestically, the sequel now stands at $77 million with $100 million globally. So expect a third chapter in this franchise.
Oh, boy.
Yay! The Boy was number 9. From STX Entertainment. That brought in $4.1 million. The horror film has made a respectable worldwide total of $36.4 million. Oh, not bad on the return.
Yeah.
In the second week in cinemas is Lionsgate Dirty Grandpa. That took in $4 million, putting it in the number 10 spot. The Robert De Niro, Zac Efron R-rated comedy has made $29.3 million.
Still have not. No.
I
don't
want to see it.
Yeah, I have a little bit of interest in it.
Uh-huh. At number 11 is The Fifth Wave, the alien invasion movie starring Chloe Grace Moretz.
Yeah.
continues to plummet with only $3.7 million for the week and $25.6 million total. Oof. And rounding out the 12 is 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. That took in $2.9 million. Michael Bay's film has brought in $47.7 million in the U.S. and $50.9 million worldwide. Opening on Friday, February 12th, is Fox's highly anticipated Deadpool, How to Be Single, and Zoolander number 2.
Good. Where so was, that's the box office. Where was Jane Got Her Gun?
I don't even think it was on the big chart.
Fell off the map.
So. All right, well, let's start reviewing some movies, doggone it. Let's see. Hail Caesar did quite well.
The Army of technicians and actors and top-notch artistic people are working hard to bring to the screen our biggest release of the year. Hail Caesar is a prestige picture with one of the biggest stars in the world, Baird Whitlock.
A truth we could see if we had, but if we had... Faith! Cut!
I mean, it came in number 2, made, what, $11 million, which is probably did a little better than I expected. It's probably not going to, it's probably dropped quite a bit next weekend.
Well, considering the star power and how many commercials and ads there were for it, that's pretty low, you know. That's, you know, I would have thought that it might have, you know, even gotten number 1 or something like that.
Well, we all saw it Friday night, and we liked it a lot. It's the story of... It's a day in the life of Eddie Mannix. Eddie Mannix was played by Josh Brolin, and he was the studio fixer that sort of takes care of problems that pop up in the studio and with their stars, etc., and makes them disappear. It's a very dense film, and I actually saw people walking out of it because I think people were expecting a more conventional comedy. It's really aimed at people who are fans of old movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, movies from the 40s and 50s especially. It takes place in 1951.
It's marketed, the way it's marketed, the commercials give you... You think you're going into one film, and when you're actually going into something else.
You think you're going into something entertaining, and then you see that.
Yeah. You could,
I thought it was
very entertaining.
Michael
especially
gave
the sort
four
of
stars.
The film, the movies within the movie, I thought were really fun. Mm-hmm. The main film is called Hail Caesar, A Story of Christ, which is Ben-Hur. That was the subtitle of Ben-Hur, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But 1951, I think, was the same year Quo Vadis came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think George Clooney as Baird Whitlock is sort of doing a riff on Charlton Heston in some of his scenes. In fact, I think there's more scenes with George Clooney when he's movies within the movie than there are George Clooney when he's actually playing Baird Whitlock.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great character named Hobie Doyle, played by Alden Einrich. I think he was my favorite character.
Yeah, that's the best part of the film.
He was this sort of very likable singing cowboy star who they were trying to dress up and put in this sort of Preston Sturges-style comedy with this director played by Ray Fiennes, who was just hilarious.
Isn't
he? Just getting frustrated at this cowpoke who really isn't a very good actor.
Boy, I wish the movie had all been about him.
Wouldn't that have been something?
That would have been a great movie.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. How about the Channing Tatum part, though?
Well, it's...
With the whole Russian sub and...
Well, it's kind of ridiculous, you know.
I think it's supposed to be ridiculous.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, I guess that I imagine, you know, Joel and Ethan kind of, you know, chuckling to themselves. It's like, oh, what if Donald Trump and the guys were really working for the Soviets
exactly.
all along?
Yes.
You know, like, this is like the anti-Trumbo.
And they weren't?
But I don't think so. They were. They just made some bad choices along the way.
And Scarlett Johansson's character was a nice addition.
That subplot goes nowhere. Yeah. It seems like.
Most of these actors don't have very big parts. I mean, George Clooney. I mean, definitely Josh Brolin. It's really his story, and everyone else is sort of supporting parts. Scarlett Johansson. Jonah Hill's I think is just in one scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Tilda Swinton. She plays two parts.
Yeah, that's true.
She's kind of doing a riff on Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper, her rivalry. Plus, they throw in the fact that they're twins,
so they've got
the little Dear Abby Ann Landers thing going.
Yeah,
there,
but
too.
I thought, like I say, this part with this cowboy Hobie Doyle was really charming. He goes out on a date with who was the banana headed lady,
Carmen Miranda.
Carmen Miranda.
It's kind of a cross between her and Lupe Velez.
Yeah, and that was a cute scene when they're out having dinner.
Yeah, I'd Doctor Dre, I wish it were all about him. You know, it's his scenes are very entertaining. His character still has sort of an innocence about him, uh-huh. which is kind of refreshing. You know, the rest of the film is fairly cynical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's a fun character. Mm-hmm. He's kind of a cross between Gene Autry and Gary Cooper and John Wayne, and those sequences are very entertaining. But for the most part, it was just the Coens sort of indulging their desire to recreate old Hollywood, which a lot of films can do. I mean, you take, Young Frankenstein, that, recreates the James Whale Frankensteins, but, just recreating it is quite enough. There just didn't seem to be a point to a lot of the scenes,
Well, it wasn't a broad comedy like the Mel Brooks stuff.
Well, it was just kind of like, hey, we can still do this, and here's, our tribute to him, but there was really no point to the scenes. I mean, the whole water ballet scene with the Scarlett Johansson is kind of fun and campy, but there's not an interesting twist on it from the old Esther Williams.
But it was still a lot of fun to sit through and watch. I agree, though, it's not one of the Coen's better movies. It's kind of a lesser Coen light. I think it's probably along the lines of the Hudsucker Proxy, maybe.
They had some great below the line support from cinematographer Roger Deakins. I mean, the scene with Scarlett Johansson, the Esther Williams scene, was beautifully shot, and a great score once again from Carter Burwell. So I appreciate the behind the scenes crew.
But I think the editor Roderick James, he kind of fumbled the ball here. He's usually really tight on the editing, and of course we know who Roderick James is.
Yes.
So. But I don't know. It just seemed a lot of it was kind of self indulgent, and just we're going to do old Hollywood just for old Hollywood's sake, and not really have a point to it. Unlike Barton Fink, which is sort of set in that same universe in Capitol Studios. And, they throw around Eddie Maddox was a real person. Mm-hmm. He was a fixer for MGM. He mentions about having to report to Joseph Schenck, who was one of the founders of 20th Century Fox. I don't know. It just kind of wishy-washy, and it just kind of plods along.
Yeah, it's a pretty great film, but it's not a great Coen Brothers film. If it had been directed by someone else, we'd probably be praising it a little bit more. Expectation.
I don't think so.
All right, let's move along then. Jim, you got to see The Choice.
Can you open our puppies? The puppies.
Good, we're all good now.
What am I going to do with all you guys, huh? Thank you, Travis.
I think that's the first time you said my name. Okay.
Oh, lucky me.
Yeah. That was this Nicholas Sparks thing. Ben Walker, I think, stars.
Benjamin Walker and Teresa Palmer.
What's it about?
It's the usual romance. From the Nicholas Sparks factory. And luckily this time they've avoided some of the cliches that are so prevalent in his other movies, like The Lucky One and Safe Haven. It's about this fellow. You see him at the start of it. It's Benjamin Walker. He's a good old boy in North Carolina. He's chugging along in his boats. And when the film starts, he's talking about the big decision he's having to make. And then they flash back 7 years. He's sort of a party guy. He's a ladies' man. And that all sort of ends when someone rents the house next to him. And that someone is Teresa Palmer's Gabby, who is a medical student. She's working at the local hospital. She's having a romance with one of the doctors played by Smallville's Tom Welling. And everything's going along until, he plays his music too loud and they have a meet cute and they're arguing. And she's concerned that her dog is pregnant and that Benjamin Walker, his character is Travis, that Travis's dog is impregnated. Ernie,
this sounds charming.
True. Oh, yeah. And they have a fight when they first meet. But, Travis's sister, who is played by Maggie Grace, and she observes it, and after Teresa or Gabby leaves, she says, "Oh, Travis, you're in trouble, because, there's something going on." And he recommends she take her dog to this animal clinic, and guess who's one of the vets at the animal clinic? Why, it's Travis and his kindly widowed father, Shep, played by Tom Wilkinson.
Okay. And it seems... Shep?
Yeah, Shep. Okay. And
I think that's the first time Tom Wilkinson has played a character named Shep.
So it seems to be another cliche that that Sparks will bring in an older, established actor to sort of mentor and sort of steer the young couple towards each other. And that's the point of Tom Wilkinson's character. It's a shame to see such a fine actor having to, you know, to do this sort of thing.
I'm sure he was well paid.
Yeah. I'm sure he wasn't doing it as a favor or anything like that.
I'll be interested to see how it does over Valentine's Day weekend.
You know, another thing that makes it kind of dull, well, everyone is just really nice in it. You know, there's no big conflicts in it. You know, Tom Welling is a little miffed, of course, that his gal gets stolen. There's no children in danger, which is a popular theme in a lot of the Sparks flicks. There's no, you know, parents or evil ex-suitors trying to break them apart. They do get caught in the rain, so he's got the cliche going of the couple having to get wet or drenched or whatever. But it just kind of meanders around. I guess I can mention about what the decision is or the choice is, the decision is, because they show it in the trailers. You see him weeping over Gabby in the hospital bed, and that's the big thing in the modern part of the film.
Yeah.
But
who is this young actress?
Young actress Teresa Palmer. You probably remember her from Warm Bodies, the zombie romance film a couple of years ago. And Take Me Home Tonight before that.
She sort of looks like Kristen Stewart.
A little bit of her and Kristen Bell thrown in a bit, but she's very appealing in it. Mm-hmm. But hate to invoke the author's names, but there's no Sparks in this Sparks film.
I get it.
And there's just there's no heat between them. And the one thing that irked me was Benjamin Walker's character has these wispy little sideburns. I'm like, for goodness sakes, grow sideburns, do it. You know.
I really like him. I really liked him in The Heart of the Sea, and then he was also in Abraham Lincoln, but this after the third, ooh.
But yeah, he's just not found his niche in films quite yet. Mm-hmm. I understand he's a stage actor.
He's more of
too.
A stage, right?
But he's kind of unbelievable as this, you know, really can't fail ladies' man, and it's just kind of a mediocre effort.
All right. So, Jim, you reviewed it at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. How many stars did you give it?
I think I gave it 1.5, maybe, something like that.
So Jim does not like Nicholas Sparks, the choice, although maybe a 14-year-old girl would. Let's move along now to Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which all three of us saw. I reviewed that at WeAreMovieGeeks.com, and I gave it 4 out of 5 stars.
A young woman must be many things. Kind, well-read, and accomplished. But to survive in the world as we know it, she'll need other qualities.
I thought that was it was a pretty rocking little horror action period piece. Mm-hmm. It's based on, of course, Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, and I was sort of struck at how faithful it was to that story. They really made a point of introducing all the major characters from that novel and had them hook up and deal make with their parents about matrimony, et cetera, just like they do in the book. And if you take out the zombie stuff, you have kind of a pretty faithful remake of Pride and Prejudice. But no, they threw in the zombies, which was a lot of fun. Who's this actress, Cinderella?
Lily James.
Lily James, yeah, I really like her a lot. She's great.
Bella Heathcote.
Bella Heathcote.
That's a great cast.
That's a great name, Bella Heathcote. Mm-hmm. I'm going to change my name to
Very
Bella
British.
Heathcote. Wow. Yes, she was in, I recognized her from Dark Shadows.
Yes, yes, which from the same author, actually. The fellow that penned the original book, Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies, also did the screenplay for that awful Dark Shadows.
But I like Pride and Prejudice and Zombies quite a bit. It seemed like the zombies at sometimes were something of an afterthought. I mean, I think there was probably a 30 or 40 minute part in the middle where there weren't even any zombies because there were so.
Was it that short a time? Oh gosh!
But it's PG-13, so it's not a particularly gory zombie movie. Your average episode of A Walking Dead probably has more beheadings than this thing. They do this thing a couple of times where they have the zombie point of view, where the zombie gets beheaded and the blood drips onto the camera. That was kind of a clever way to skirt the PG-13 rating. It's not a very long film. It's only about 100 minutes long, so it moves really quickly.
I liked that Charles dance.
Matt Smith was great.
Matt Smith was good. I like that it's a woman centric. You know, he even says the line. He goes, I brought my daughters not to be in the kitchen, but to be fighters and kind of like this warrior. So I really appreciated that aspect of the film. Yeah, it was really good.
He had sent him to China to practice
instead of Japan, right? Yeah, exactly. Kind of so they're kicking gear. Ass the whole time. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Oh boy.
I come out of it like going, yeah, this is great, and Jim's like,
I know that's the problem. It, you mentioned about the zombies being gone for a good chunk of the film, and you know, it's like, oh, we're gonna be Jane Austen for a while. Now we're going to do zombies for a while. The zombies themselves, I did like how they were showing the decaying skin, but they were able to speak, and they can some of them could pass as regular people, which is closer to vampires in my book. Mm-hmm. When I think of zombies, I think of the Rambling Ones. Right. Boy, when they when they're zombified, they can run at a good clip.
It's okay to mix up the zombie rules.
But, it does end with. Sets up a sequel,
which will never happen.
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't be so sure.
It could go right to video.
But I don't know. This movie may clean up overseas.
That's a good point.
It's got all the elements.
Oh, I think it's going to sink like a stone its second week. I think,
I love the way that the girls were introduced, putting knives and swords in their garters and their bustiers. Kind of a nice touch.
Yeah, I just didn't think there was much chemistry between the main leads, between Lily James and Sam Riley, as Colonel Darcy. Mm-hmm. Corrects everyone when he sees them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it just seems to plod along to me, and it was a long 100 minutes, it seemed like. And then it's like, oh, we're bringing in the zombies again. And they kind of waste Jack Houston as the sort of villainous or rival character. And, they're trying to make an allegory, I think, to the zombies being the lower part of the class system there in Britain, which isn't quite followed through, really.
Well, so Michelle and I really enjoy Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and Jim does not. Another movie that we get to review opens this Friday. Deadpool.
Wait! You may be wondering why the red suit. Well, that's so bad guys can't see me bleed. This guy's got the right idea. He wore the brown pants.
Jim and I saw Deadpool last week. It's a Marvel Comics movie. It's rated R. And for good reason. It's quite a vulgar, violent, nudity-filled superhero. It's a little bit different.
Yeah, no, this is not from Marvel Studios. This is from 20th Century Fox because the Deadpool is an X-Men spinoff, specifically. So.
Mm-hmm. Ryan Reynolds stars as, what was his name?
Wilson, something like that? Yes.
And Jim, you and I were talking the other day that we first saw his character in Ryan Reynolds
Wolverine Origins.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they make fun of the Wolverine Origins in the movie. In fact, they make fun of everything in
Deadpool.
Oh
my goodness, this is like the most self-parroting, referencing thing I've seen in so long.
Yeah, I mean, he's constantly looking at the camera and saying something. But let's get back to the plot a little bit. It's kind of a pretty standard superhero plot. He plays Wade Wilson, who's an Iraq vet who's working and is some sort of enforcer.
A mercenary.
Yeah, a mercenary, and he meets this beautiful woman in this bar. What was the name of the bar that was like the children's home or something?
Oh, yeah, Wayward Girls. Yeah.
Which was a front for this bar where the bartender is like dealing in arms and...
played by T.J. Miller, who's very funny in the film. Yeah. Very funny. I don't know. I almost have to expect some reviews to lead off with calling this movie Bugs Bunny Super Assassin because it has that same sort of Looney Tunes type feel that poking fun at itself. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing.
Oh yeah, but he falls in love with Hooker with a Heart of Gold, played by the beautiful Marina Bakarin, and they get married, and then he's diagnosed with cancer suddenly. Even that's funny.
Oh yeah.
And then he meets these guys that can cure his cancer, and they turn him into this superhero. But in the process, they sort of melt his skin a bit, so he looks like something like a fire victim.
Well, they have to rough him up. That's a good chunk of the film. They have to sort of heighten his system going to start up his mutant gene, mm-hmm. and to kickstart it, I guess.
Yeah. And then the X-Men are trying to recruit him. Even that's really funny. I mean, there's Colossus and, was it Negasonic Teenage Warhead?
Negasonic Teenage Warhead.
Were they in the other X?
He's never in his human form in this one. He's always the big, you know, metal giant.
Mm-hmm.
And it harkens back.
Did Vinnie Jones play him in one of the X?
No, he played Juggernaut I think the second or third one.
Okay.
But now they had a scene of them in the fight room where in one of the X-Men films where Colossus actually threw Wolverine at the Sentinels.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we got to see him before. But he wasn't a major player. But like I say, this time out, he's this hulking 8-foot-tall metal giant, mm-hmm. through the whole thing.
And then they make fun. There's one scene where he shows up at the X-Files headquarters. And you're the only two X-Men. The only two X-Men I can see. I guess the studio couldn't afford any more X-Men for this movie.
Well, I tell you, the opening, you know, make sure you get there on time for this, because the opening title, the credit sequence, I laugh more during that than I have probably since Trainwreck in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really funny. And as I understand, this is the first feature film from, I believe his name is Tim Miller.
Tim Miller, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, who's mostly known as an animator, a special effects guy.
Yeah.
And this is a very impressive day.
Video guy.
Yeah, impressive debut for him.
Ryan Reynolds has been trying to bring this to the screen since 2003.
Well, I know this is a very, very mm-hmm. popular character with the younger Marvel fans, so I think they'll be very, very happy with this film. You know, people, you know, taking their kids to it thinking it's like another Thor movie or something like that, or Spider-Man. It's not. It definitely does earn its R rating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very entertaining. At one point, Deadpool is hiding out. He crashes the pad of this woman who's this older black woman who's blind. And when she first appeared on screen, I was like, well, she kind of looks like Leslie Uggams. And that's who it is.
Really?
Yes,
she's in
Roots.
It.
And I was like, oh, my
sure
goodness.
Enough,
yeah. Yeah, the 60s pop singer shows up in this.
Yeah, well, and Deadpool makes just these, you know, snarky, smarmy comments nonstop through the entire film. But the good news is, you know, 4 out of 5 of them work. It's very, very funny.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a little bit like watching a movie with some film nerd sitting next to you making snarky comments throughout the film. it wears you down a little bit, you know, and if the jokes hadn't been as well written as they were, this movie could have been quite a chore because there's nothing... anything, you know, particularly original about the plot, but it is darn funny, and it's a comedy, and it delivers.
Oh yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I predict it'll be number one next weekend at the box office because I have all the huge fans of that character, and I think it might stick around for a little bit. So, you know, I think it could be in the top 5 for a few weeks, at least until Batman and Superman arrive. So,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And let's not forget Gina Carano. What was that Soderbergh movie she starred in?
Oh gosh, Kill Shot.
No, I know what you're talking. Yeah.
Oh well. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the first time I saw her, and I think she was even in the Fast and Furious movies.
Mm-hmm. But she has a funny smackdown with Colossus, and I love when she has a wardrobe malfunction.
Yeah, and he's all embarrassed.
Yeah, Colossus has a little bit of Captain America in him. He actually says to Deadpool a couple of times, language.
So. All right, so Jim and I highly recommend Deadpool, which opens this Friday. This week, we've got some movies we're going to be seeing. Tonight, Jim is seeing How to Be Single. That stars... Rebel Wilson and Dakota Johnson.
You're a pretty girl. This is New York City. There's like a billion people outside that door.
In every male-female friendship, there's total number of drinks.
4, 5.
And if you hit that, it means you would definitely have sex.
If I had more than 5 drinks, I'd hook up with you.
My drink number is 27. I wouldn't even touch myself on less than 24.
Get some pointers from that. Going to find out about what the other sex is thinking.
Yeah, so we'll have a review of that next week. And this afternoon, we are seeing... The Witch. The Witch is a horror movie that Michael Hafner saw at Fantastic Fest in September, mm-hmm. and is already reviewed for WeirdMovieGeeks.com. We'll be rerunning Michael's review this Thursday night, and we can talk about The Witch next Monday. That opens on the 19th. 15th. One local event that I want to talk about is my event. Starting a new film series at the Way Out Club. It will be called 16mm Double Feature Night. And our first showing is tomorrow night, which will be the 9th of February. Although starting in March, it'll be the first Tuesday of every month. So the next show will be March 1st. And I'm going to announce right here on our podcast what next month's movies are. But tomorrow night, we're showing a 16mm print. This is everything we'll show will be in 16mm. This will be old school film prints.
Yeah. Wow.
My buddy Roger owns most of these, although the first one we're showing tonight is from my collection. I own a few prints. It's Charles Bronson in Rider on the Rain, which was a movie that he made in France in 1970. It's not a Bronson movie where he blows away a bunch of people. It's a kind of a tight little thriller, a kind of a rape and revenge thing. It's really, really good. Directed by René Clément, who had won the Oscar for Forbidden Games, which was a French film that won Best Foreign Film in the early 50s, or late mid-50s, perhaps. And then after that, we are showing Ray Milland in Panic in Year Zero. That was a movie made in 1960 that Milland directed, and it also has Frankie Avalon. It's sort of a cross between an end-of-the-world adventure and a 50s juvenile delinquent movie. It's really, really good. So that is tomorrow night at the Way Out Club, starting at 8 o'clock. And next month, I can say this right now, you'll be the first audience to hear this. The movies that we're going to be showing are the 1931 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
That's the one with Frederick March.
Frederick March, yeah.
Who won an Oscar for that.
He did.
He
actually tied.
With Wallace Beery for The Champ.
And Miriam Hopkins is in it. It's really, really good. It's a
good version.
It's pre-code.
It is pre-code, and there's a lot of sexuality and a lot of violence in the film. It plays wonderfully.
Yeah, Miriam Hopkins' character really thinks highly of Dr. Jekyll, as I recall.
Yeah, it's a great movie. That'll be next month. And then double feature with that one will be John Milius's 1973 gangster opus, Dillinger.
Mm.
Oh. Dillinger stars Warren Oates as John Dillinger and Ben Johnson as the FBI agent.
Melvin Purvis.
Melvin Purvis. And Richard Dreyfuss plays Babyface Nelson.
Yeah, yeah.
And, Michelle Phillips from The Mamas and the Papas plays
she the Dillinger's lady in red?
No. Cloris Leachman's
Cloris
lady.
Cloris Leachman, that's right.
Lady
yes,
in red.
Yes.
Michelle Phillips is
his regular
his girlfriend.
Yeah.
I guess Marion Cotillard played in the Johnny Depp
Public Enemies.
Yeah, Public Enemies a few years ago. But I think Dillinger's a lot better movie than Public Enemies, and I like Public Enemies. I love Dillinger.
Yeah, Warren Oates really looks a lot like the real Dillinger.
Warren Oates was born to play Dillinger, no doubt about it. And Warren Oates is fantastic as Dillinger, and it's a very violent, wonderful movie. So that'll be March 1st at the Way Out Club, starting at 8 o'clock. So now you know what I'm showing next month. But like I say, I have access to a couple of collections, and we'll be showing a different double feature. They won't be thematically connected, so it'll be really kind of a mashup, just like tonight and or tomorrow night and next month's shows will be. All right, enough about me. Directors Guild, did they make some sort of announcement over the weekend?
They did, finally. They announced Saturday evening, and the nominees were Ridley Scott for The Martian, George Miller, Mad Max Fury Road, Adam McKay, The Big Short, Tom McCarthy, Spotlight. Ultimately, the winner was Alejandro Iñárritu for The Revenant. He won the DGA last year, so he's got back-to-back DGA wins. It's the first ever, and that's the first time ever somebody has won back-to-back DGAs.
What if he wins next year? That'd be crazy.
That would be crazy. Only 14 times in the 66 years that the DGAs have announced has the winner not gone on to win the Best Director Oscar. As far as the Oscars go with directors, Mankiewicz and John Ford are the only directors to win back-to-back Oscars. However, no filmmaker as a whole has ever won back-to-back Best Picture Oscars. So if, because I believe Iñárritu is a producer on The Revenant, as he was last year with Birdman. So it'll be interesting. At this point, the Best Picture race is anyone's game now, because the PGA, Producers Guild, went to The Big Short, the Screen Actors Guild went to Spotlight, and now the Directors Guild went to The Revenant in Iñárritu. This also propels Leonardo DiCaprio's, bid for Best Actor Oscar, which we kind of are all thinking that's kind of a done deal.
Yeah, well, last year it seemed like of the big race that the Best Picture was kind of up between Birdman and Boyhood last year, and here it's kind of a three-way thing.
Now it's anybody's game.
But the only acting category is maybe up in the air is supporting actress. I think I think the rest of them are. I think are yeah, pretty much much locked in. Mm-hmm.
We'll see. There's always a few surprises at the Academy.
Well, that's true.
They also announced, the DJ also did documentary, and that went to, surprisingly, Cartel Land over Amy.
Yeah, I saw that.
That was very telling. Also, they also have a category for first-time director, and that went to Alex Garland for Ex Machina, a film we all liked. So that's how the DJs panned out.
Can we talk about the Annie's?
And I was going to say, I was going to hand it over to you for the Annie Awards.
Yeah, at the same evening, I believe. Asifa Hollywood, the animation people, did their annual Annie Awards, and as was expected, the big winner, of course, was Inside Out.
What a shock.
Pretty much got all the major awards except for Best Animated Special Effects, which went to another Pixar film, The Good Dinosaur, so they sort of threw it a bone. The one award that Inside Out that gave me especially gave us a lot of fun was Best Voice Acting in a Feature Film, and that was won by our buddy, St. Louis's own Phyllis Smith, as Sadness in Inside Out.
Who was she up against?
I don't know what the other people in the category were, but
is it
a
woman, or is it just...
Just in general.
Just a general voice.
Yeah. Yeah, just they don't have a, you know, best actress, actor, actress in that. But they also gave a special award to, they called, he named me Malala for its special animated sequences that depicted what was going on, in her life. And they also gave a special achievement in visual effects award to The Revenant for Judy the Bear.
What about Anomalisa? Did it get any love?
Bupkis. Yeah, it Shaun the Sheep, Peanuts, all great films. Got nothing at the Annies this year.
How long have they been doing these Annies?
I think at least 25-30 years, something like that. But one of the people online was saying that a few years ago there was a big stink, a big controversy because the Pixar people were aggravated that Kung Fu Panda swept everything, and they wanted the voting to be overhauled. And now they're wondering, hey, are they going to make the same complaint this year because it was all Pixar stuff? Highly unlikely that's going to happen.
Yeah. No black animators were nominated. So
I think in the TV categories.
Oh, I'm just being obnoxious.
Yeah, so, I mean, except for the Writers Guild, everybody, I mean, the editors announced, you know, last week, and that went to Mad Max. Yeah, that was Mad Max for dramatic feature in The Big Short for, you know, comedy. So
WGA next weekend?
I believe that's coming up. But it's all over the place. There is no clear front runner except for the acting, but the main one, directing and best picture, I still think is going to be a surprise.
But I do think that Inside Out will, you know, definitely get the Oscar for best animated feature. Yeah, I think that's a lock, pretty much.
I think Mad Max is going to win all 10 Oscars it's nominated for. And maybe even a write-in on a couple more.
It's the color of the sky in your world, right, Tom? But Mad Max is a great film.
It is. It's really great.
But it'll be thought of highly for a long, long time.
I'd be happy to see Margaret Sixel win for editing. I would just be thrilled. Be a nice way to award the film.
You know, I watched Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome for the first time in a couple of decades over the weekend because I got Hulu. I've seen Mad Max many, many times. I've seen Road Warrior a gazillion times, and I've seen the new one. I saw it 5 times at the theater, but that sort of the bastard child, Thunderdome, and it's really not very good.
It's not gotten better over the years.
No, it hasn't. I hadn't watched it in a long time, and I thought, well, maybe it's not as bad as I remember. I remember being horribly disappointed at it.
I remember on the heels of Road Warrior. Yeah. It was like, what is this with all the kids and everything?
Yeah, and very little action. There's a couple of action sequences, but they're nothing compared to Road Warrior, especially this new one. But I do like Hulu. Do you Hulu?
I do. I have, that and Netflix.
I just discovered Hulu over the weekend.
It's that and Netflix, both are really...
Well, Hulu especially for TV. Yes. If you miss a show on, you know, Monday night, you can watch it the next day, Tuesday, with limited commercial interruptions.
With the movie selection is what I was impressed with at Hulu. And, I mean, they got all the Criterions.
Yeah, that's very impressive.
Yeah. Although they're not HD over at Hulu. Everything at Netflix is HD, but not at Hulu. which is a little disappointing. But what I watched last night, I watched 52 Pickup with Roy Scheider.
Oh, yeah, and Ann Margaret.
I hadn't seen that in 20 years.
Yeah, how does that hold up after 20 years?
It's still a pretty good movie.
It's a pretty good thriller. John Schlesinger is
directed it. Yeah, John Schlesinger directed it. Yeah. John Glover was the villain, and Kelly Preston, where he murders Kelly Preston in sort of a brutal scene, and Vanity.
Gonna frame Roy Scheider for it.
Something else we watched over the weekend was the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. Who won?
Some sort of sporting event, Denver. I was understand. Yeah, yeah.
Who won in the commercial sweepstakes, though? Super Bowl is great for Movie Bus because a lot of times they'll run spots for movies that are coming out, you know, like this summer, for example, and these are new spots.
They save them usually, and they premiere them
at the Super Bowl, and there was some good ones last night. Michelle, why don't you take over?
We saw a new spot for Deadpool. We saw a great spot for Captain America's Civil War.
Yeah, first look at Ant-Man and the sort of got to see the heroes facing off against each other. It was interesting.
Wasn't it great?
Yeah. No Spidey, though. No Spidey.
I know. Everybody was hoping we were going to see his hand or something.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, no. We also saw Lionsgate's Gods of Egypt, a new spot for that. We got a little more footage from 10 Cloverfield Lane. Paramount Pictures' upcoming film opens in March.
John Goodman?
Yeah. Definitely. Eddie the Eagle,
That'll come up in the next couple of weeks. I've seen that film already. I can't really talk about it, but
word on it is that it's charming. It's great. It's a good little film.
Yeah.
We also got a new poster. We also saw new footage from The Jungle Book, which was really hilarious. We heard more of Baloo the Bear, played by Bill Murray. Universal Pictures surprised everyone and gave us the first footage of Jason Bourne with Matt Damon.
Yeah. And that's the official title, Jason Bourne?
It looked like Jason 1, 2, or 3, and 4 to me.
That's up on our site. We have a new poster. Yeah, they released a bunch of new things. 20th Century Fox also released Independence Day Resurgence.
Yeah.
Some new footage for that.
So Will Smith's not in that?
Nope.
Well, come he didn't come back for that?
Vivica Fox is in it.
She
needs a job.
Is Bill Pullman in it?
He's in it. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah.
Fox also gave us a new spot, new footage for X-Men Apocalypse.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that.
Yeah.
It looked good.
Paramount also, in addition to 10 Cloverfield Lane, they also gave us new footage from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle 2. It's also got a subtitle with it. Jim and I also.
Yeah.
Go ahead, take it.
Well, I think the most interesting film promotion was probably for Turkish Airlines.
Yes.
They had competing spots with Turkish Airlines talking about their new flights to Gotham City and Metropolis. And, of course, they had to have a prominent citizen for each of the cities helping to promote it. So you had Ben Affleck as Bruce Wayne inviting viewers to come visit Gotham City. It's having a resurgence. For Metropolis, it was Lex Luthor, Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor.
Really clever promotion for Batman, for Superman, Justice League, which opens up in March.
We have a guest in the studio. Filmmaker Tony Monahan is here. And Tony has made a new documentary called Rednecks and Gulches.
I found a different breed of people here than in construction than I have worked with before on my adventures.
It's because we're being open and honest. Yeah, I mean, putting all the chips on the table,
everything on the table.
But is it wise to always put all your chips on the table?
Heaven won't take me, though, before I'll take over. Because you know what? I'm going to kick some motherfucking ass before I die.
Colchis.
Colchis. I am so sorry. Colchis. Well, it's still a word I'm completely unfamiliar with.
And it's a very hard word to understand from American concept.
Yeah.
It's a slang name for Irish guys that grew up in the country.
Is that right? What would be the equivalent English word of Colchis?
English word and from England or from Ireland aspect?
Well, is Colchis sort of the Irish version of redneck?
Yeah, something similar, yeah. Okay. Like a guy that grew up on a farm, was used to turn his hands from any concept you could think of, from messing with horses to cattle, like fixing cars or tractors, which I'm no good at.
But you grew up in Ireland, correct?
I grew up in Ireland.
And on a farm, right?
On a little farm, yeah, in the west of Ireland.
So would you be considered a culture yourself?
Yeah, I'm 100% culture, I'd say. Because I have all the qualifications.
So you moved from, when did you move from Ireland to St. Louis then? How old were you?
When did I move from Ireland to St. Louis? I didn't moved from Ireland to St. Louis at the start. I lived in England for a long time. So that's where I lived there for 4 or 5 years in England.
And what brought you to St. Louis then?
Well, what brought me to St. Louis? Eventually, I had lived all over the place. I came to the U.S. and I lived in New York for a while. I came out to the Bronx, actually, to box here from England. That's how I ended up in New York, was one of my ambitions. I used to be a boxer. Oh. I didn't mention that in my documentary, though, but I have all the qualifications of an Irish guy, fighting and drinking and all the craziness mm-hmm. along with it. I lived in New York for a while, and then I met my ex in New York, in the Bronx, actually. She was living up there mm-hmm. from, and she was from St. Louis. That was my St. Louis connection. That's how I ended up in St. Louis.
I see.
And I got three daughters here at the moment, mm-hmm. Tony, Ursula, and Kira. Mm-hmm. So I lived in New York for a few years, and I used to...
So you ran a construction business here in St. Louis. Was it called Irish Construction?
I own a construction company here called Irish Construction, yeah.
You hire mostly Irish?
No, I hire all class of people. Mm-hmm. I don't distinguish between anybody, mm-hmm. black, Mexicans. I don't care if they're from space, if they qualify and do the work. I'm from the world. I'm like from the ground up. I don't really have any ethnic or anything. If they're good workers, I'll hire them. If they're nice people, I'll keep them on. It doesn't make no difference. I don't mm-hmm. go out of my way to find Irish or English. I find what's available, and if they're good, I work mm-hmm. them.
So how did you get the idea then to make this film, Rednecks and Colchis? Was it working with these American Colchis?
Well, if I go back to my beginning where I was a kid, I was like going to school. I was taught in Gaelic, and I had a teacher. And anyways, I used to be the joke of the class. I think that's where it started all out from. That I used to be like the kid that was scared. I used to be beaten all the time, and I was like the joke. And the teachers, I was like, you're going back a good few years now. And so when I was a kid, I was always the joke of the school, pretty much. I was the fool. Now, I was a really good-looking kid, and everything was going great, but I could never imagine, like my daughters nowadays, how I brought them up and how they've been treated. I can't understand that people would do that to each other, but that's how I grew up in the west of Ireland, because there was no system. There was only the rich and the poor, and the poor were treated like second-class citizens. So I've been against the elements from that aspect, because my teacher used to tell me one often and beat me in the front of the class. I was a joke of the class going to school, like the joke, and every day he'd say, you're too thick to teach, and I was just didn't know what they were on about. I just took the beatings then all the time. They'd get beaten. It was like going to school. I knew it was going to get better every day. It made no difference, you know. And then I started being radical, and I'd just get in more trouble with the kids, you know. Mm-hmm. So from that, it grew on like that. When I got older, when I got younger, I just couldn't wait to get away from home then, because I just wanted to leave Ireland, because it was just, at that time, I come from 11 kids, and there's it was like, a lot of families would move out anyways. It was like a part of, you know, 12 or 10, you'd know that you were going to leave the country or go somewhere, because there was nothing there for you. There was no future. If you didn't have money or have a lot of land or something, you were just like a working class, whatever. Mm. It was like a part of a machinery, more or less, you know what I mean?
Mm.
And you didn't get the, you know, like people nowadays, they overdo it with their kids, and you know, the mothers and fathers didn't have the time to put in their kids, I don't think, at that time, because they were just so busy trying to survive and live and eat. Because when starvation is there's not many more opportunities for you.
That's
what I got from. I'd done a lot of stuff in life that no one ever said. I had no education whatsoever. The 3 or 4 years I went to school, they were irrelevant to me. But I always said I was going to face the odds and test the elements out. So that was just part of it. I traveled the whole world, lived in different places, seen sunsets in Miami, seen sunsets in Hawaii, lived all over Europe. And I done all this because I said it's like a fish swimming up like a salmon. I just done it because I was going to do it, because I didn't think, I looked at the world in different ways than from being a kid. I said, you know, you don't have to go to Harvard or anything of this stuff to see the world, and you don't have to be told, like when you're a kid, that you're going to be stupid. And I broke all the barriers in that aspect. So when it came back to the movie, I talked around St. Louis about it, and I talked more or less trying to get help of all the people, because I wanted to get the money from people in film schools and all that stuff. So I went around to places and I told them my story, and they all listened to me and entertained me. But then when I left, that's all they ever heard from them. No one ever followed me up. I said, listen, I'd like to put a film crew with you. You got a great idea. Mm-hmm. I went around and I done the chats, the talk shows, like for the film places, see would I get help, and people who'd made films before. But everybody there was like so in love with themselves, and I knew when I was halfway through the speech, I said, it's a waste of time talking here, because these people ain't going to back me. So eventually I said to myself, without telling my crew, which my financial part I always kept to myself, so I said, I'll do it myself. I never know had I got $5,000 or had it $700,000. I just played, all right, I'll start this, and then I'll work my way through it. Mm-hmm. And I did. I worked like 7 days a week, every day, took every job I could get, brought the guys with me on the jobs, bought the equipment, found two good guys to work with. I should mention their name, Elliot Gillette and Chris Gibbs. Mm-hmm. Chris Gibbs was a cameraman. He lived with me for, he was only supposed to live with me for about 6 weeks because I thought I could have this documentary. And I thought I could have done it in my own craziness. I thought I could do it. The most it'll take is 2.5 months, I said. So I had a budget for that, a little bit of money saved. So eventually, I'm 7 months into this and it's still not finished.
Yeah.
And my and it's just going from day to day then and then. But eventually, we start putting it together and I said I want to be different than most documentaries or stuff that I've seen on TV. So I used to set up then like little panels at night for doing this. Like we do a rough shot of the film at the start. I bring in about 10 different people every time and have like wine for them and cheese and get their opinions and say what they couldn't understand and what didn't make sense. So I kept doing that for a few, months.
Let me ask you, was the documentary envisioned as a final product or did it sort of unveil itself as you were filming as far as what directions it went?
Well, I knew there were some great stories there because I love people whose characters. I like, because I always find people amazing. Like if I even sit, if you ever sit at a bus stop, you'll always get into a great conversation with people. And I find that there's more to people than people ever, especially nowadays, because we write each other off all the time. We don't acknowledge each other. You know, we look at each other and say, can I get out of that guy? Or what can he do for me? Or I never looked at people that way. I looked at people like, if there's a good story there, I'll listen to it. And I always like listening to stories. And I always like telling stories about places I've been and where I was. But the story, back to the movie again, some of the stuff that we thought was going to be bad when we were filming it turned out to be really great stories because we found stuff as we went along that the guys were more willing to share sometimes if you got more personal with them. And if you were, they told the story because, let me see, because I could relate to some of the stuff they went through with themselves. I could relate to it. So they tell me the stories on a first-hand basis. They didn't need to be, you know, they were straightforward with their stories. So that's what I liked because I didn't approach them like, because everyone said, these guys ain't going to talk in front of the camera. And I said, they'll talk in front of the camera because if you go about it the right way. And they did. They all talked and they all told their story.
And I, judging by the trailer, it seems like a lot of what they talk about is their drug use.
Well, that's probably on the, a lot of that is on the trailer, but it's about an immigrant coming here to me meeting these people. It's like Lewis and Clark, really, because I never met people like that before in my life. I've ran into a new frontier here, and I've been all around the world, but I never met people like that. They talk about their drugs, but if you go through the... It's about their lives and their loves and their girlfriends and their kids. There's a lot of that in it, too, and the nights they've... The loneliness they put in dealing with these, you know, demons that they're carrying. So a lot of it is... it's funny and it's sad and it's true. It's all the above. So I wanted that in it. Like I didn't want it to make these. I didn't want to make it about guys that are addicted. I wanted to show the backstory that they had a life and they come from really good families. Some of them, wealthy families. Some of them, and they had good schooling. They had good education. Some of them are musicians growing up. Some of them had great careers. And some of them still in the masonry business. Their careers are a casual work, whatever you want to call it.
So you've screened it a couple times. You screened it at the High Point last year, and you screened it at the St. Louis Filmmakers Showcase. How has it been received so far?
So far, everyone, like when I put the trailer on my Facebook trailer, within a month, we got like 3 million hits in it. So I knew then it was going to be good. And then I went to the High Point one night with my daughter. The guy that owned the High Point is a really nice guy. So he said, I'm going to show your trailer along with the other movies. And there were 4 or 5 movies out there at the same time. And like you go in first. So I took my daughter, my youngest daughter, and Kira and to see it. And when I seen it, I was like, I couldn't believe that we made this because it looked like a guy from Hollywood would have made it. You know what I mean? And it showed the same thing. I knew then when I seen the trailer. I just walked out. I seen the trailer. I knew that it was going to be a success because...
Yeah.
It had all the making of a good... When I seen it on the big screen, it was like, I couldn't believe that we put it together.
And what are the future plans for the film?
Well, the future plans now, it's out on it's on Amazon. Brink Vision is carrying it. They're a big distributor, one of the biggest ones, I think, in the world. Fourth biggest in the world, I've been told. So they're going to show it in 19th of April. It's going to be out on, I think it's on Netflix and all the channels, or most of them anyway.
Okay.
And I think that it's when it's going to be shown all around, and like in Australia, New Zealand and England, and they'll see an Irish guy dealing with these American guys, mm-hmm. which I've not seen before, ever. Mm-hmm. It's unique. And I think it'll be like a big conversation. I left the documentary open so that people will, someday they'll be working and they'll say, oh, that's what he meant. Mm-hmm. I didn't close anything up. Yeah. So they'll figure out themselves. There's stuff in there that will say, well, like sometimes really good films. I used to say, I haven't seen many films in years. I don't watch much. Mm-hmm. films, but the old films I used to watch, like Marlon Brando films, like Stella and all that stuff, you'll always remember the words, you'll always remember like mm-hmm. what they meant and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and the Cagney movies, you know.
Sure. Like, but now there's talk of maybe expanding into a TV series of Rednecks and Colchis, is that correct?
Yeah, there's,
can you talk about that a little bit?
We're talking about that at the moment, and there's an offer on the table. Mm-hmm. And we'll see how it goes. And at the moment, it looks good. They said they can, you know, get a TV to carry us, and we'll go from there. So mm-hmm. we'll see. We're working on that at the moment, and it seems pretty positive. But mm-hmm. I believe stuff when I see it. You know.
Okay. Well, good luck with Rednecks and Colchis. We look forward to seeing it, and maybe we'll have you back in here if you start production on this TV show about it. Tony Monahan, thanks a lot for joining us, and you brought your friend Mariah Riffley here.
Mariah here. Yeah, she works at my office, and she helps me out, and she keeps me on top of things. Okay. So. So thank you so much for having me here. Say hello.
Hello, you.
Mariah. Thank you. And we're going to have to wrap it up. We've run out of time. We'll be back next week. We'll get to review How to Be Single, and we'll review The Witch, and we'll talk about a bunch of other things because we always do. But for now, I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And listen to us again next week.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather,
oh, nice, Dave. Hello, darling. Hey, 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 hey.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock.